It's 8:29, and we have with us here in the studios John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
And a lovely day for the upcoming Rolling Thunder Down Home Democracy Tour happening later today. I understand you're both going to be making appearances.
I'll be there.
We'll both be there.
You will. Excellent.
Magnuson Park, out of a standpoint. We'll give the details later on this half hour.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. And
I wanted to say thank you also for we had a benefit concert last week that a lot of people listening, or some of the people listening, went to, and I just wanted to say thanks. It was a wonderful event. You, Mike, played a key role in it and emceed and did a lot of behind the scenes work. Thank you for that. And it was just a very wonderful kind of community event. So very, very, very heartwarming.
Yeah, it was cool. There was a lot of really good people there, and I want to thank all of them for turning out. Yeah, excellent music. Janet Stecker just pulled together like six fabulous bands, and for those of you that missed it, you missed out big time.
Yep,
so.
Blew it.
So, all right. Well, let's jump into this week's news and events. As always, people are doing things behind our backs that not giving us the full scoop. And luckily, we bring you both in each week so that you can shine that little
complain
spotlight.
About it.
Yes.
All right. Well, and one of the things
breakfast with the malcontents. That's us.
Yeah, we're giving people something to chew on early in the morning. One of the things that's been happening for a while, it is this crazy idea of a streetcar here in South Lake Union.
Yes, and this week, Richard Conlon, one of our city council members, came up with a proposal that would produce no city money for the streetcar. That's a blow to the streetcar supporters, I'm sure. Now, the streetcar is supposed to cost...
No, this was passed by the council, wasn't it?
Also? No, it hasn't been passed yet. It's just been proposed. $45 million is what it's going to cost to build the streetcar. That's the optimistic estimate. And another optimistic estimate is $1.5 million per year to run it. Another very optimistic estimate is 35 riders per hour per car on the line, with two cars on the line. Now, a service that costs $1.5 million per year to run and $45 million to build and only serves about 70 riders per hour, you got to scratch your head over that. But private businesses in South Lake Union say that they will tax themselves to pay for $25 million of the cost to build it, and they wanted the rest of it. Greg Nichols had proposed that the rest of it come from city and state and possibly federal money, but the city council had to approve that, and they've come up with a plan that says no city money for this, and that's good. That's a good thing, I think. However, their plan also requires that the rest of the money, the other $20 billion or $20 million to build it, should come from state and federal sources. Now, the federal sources, with a record deficit, you guys can get up this morning and open up your papers and see record federal deficit as the headline in your morning papers today.
Yeah. About which more shortly?
Right, which we'll talk about later. And with the state having problems funding anything in the Tri-County area, in fact, they set up a Tri-County Commission to supposedly come up with a plan for voters in the three counties of King, Pierce, and Snohomish to vote on to tax ourselves to build things like a replacement for the Alaskan Way Viaduct and to upgrade our bridges and I-5, et cetera, et cetera. With the Tri-County Commission unable to do that, the question arises, what the heck are these guys thinking? What the heck is Greg Nichols and the city council and the South Lake Union businessmen thinking, you know, when they say, well, we'll get the rest of the money from the state and federal sources? And the truth is they're going to have a really, really hard time getting anything for this. Now the legislation that Conlon proposed also requires the study of two additional streetcar lines, one from South Lake Union to the U District, and the other one, which would extend the waterfront streetcar along South Jackson Street into the and through the International District. Now, some of the folks who have been looking at this at the streetcar line, some of the critics looking at the streetcar line say, well, God, you know, if you're going to build a streetcar, it should be the International District one, because that one would have more ridership and be much more necessary than the one in South Lake Union. Of course, the South Lake Union backers don't want that. And then other people like me would look at this proposal and say, what? A streetcar from South Lake Union to the U District? What are they thinking? The U District is the most served neighborhood for Metro bus service in the city. Pretty much. I mean, the only other neighborhood you could say was served better would maybe be South Queen Anne.
Yeah, but what it's missing is what you're missing is that it's also a neighborhood that's got some biotech in it, and so it's basically a shuttle service for the biotech industry.
Yeah,
is what they're proposing.
Yeah, but they can take the bus.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's my point, is that you're talking about a neighborhood that is the best served with bus service in the city. So this vanity project for South Lake Union businesses really is not anything that deserves any public money, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, there was also a stipulation, I thought, as part of the conditions, that they study how much economic benefit would accrue to the businesses along the route to the South Lake Union streetcar by building it. That was part of the package also, so that they could tell whether the $25 million contribution was outweighed by the economic benefits they were going to get, and whether that amount can be upped.
Yeah, and so that'll be another thing that will probably kill the proposal altogether, is that requirement. That and the fact that there's no city money going in, and that it's going to be really hard to get any state and federal funds for it.
I find it kind of interesting that the group that they put together for the Tri-County area for the big transportation plan there, mm-hmm. one of the funders and one of the contributing groups there, I don't know if contributing is really the right word, one of the groups involved in that is Vulcan, mm-hmm. that's given the thumbs down to, you know, the transportation plans that have come through there. You know, Vulcan is one of the big ones that's pushing for the streetcar down in this area. You know, it's like, so the big project that would serve all of us, no. The project that would serve our neighborhood immediately, yeah.
Or, yes, yeah, serve Vulcan's interests in South Lake Union.
Yeah, yeah, and increase the because it's a fixed transportation infrastructure, it would increase their property values also, and I'm sure that's hasn't escaped their attention.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So this proposal, Conlon's proposal, will be discussed at the next Council Transportation Committee meeting, which is on August 10th. And then if everything goes smoothly, it's going to be voted on by the full council by August 16th.
I'd also be curious to know how many, there's a lot of times when things get through a committee meeting, you know, you get the thumbs up on that or the thumbs down, and then mm-hmm. it's totally different when it reaches the entire council.
Yeah.
So that's going to be an interesting
thing.
So
it'll be
to
interesting
watch.
To see how that mm-hmm. turns out. And of course, folks can sit in on those meetings too and hopefully be able to comment on it.
Yeah, or even give a call to your councilman mm-hmm. if you think it's
give
a good
a
idea or a bad
send
idea.
Send them some email or a letter.
Or both, or all of them.
All of those things.
Participate. It's a democracy, after all. At least that's what they say on the brochure. All right, let's move along. Article this week about uninsured health care costs going up in the state.
Yeah, our insurance commissioner, Mike Kreidler, who is going to be up for re-election, so he's... got off his behind and is doing some work. He, along with some healthcare advocates and some labor union folks, released some data this week regarding uninsured people in the state of Washington. The data shows that taxpayers and folks who have health insurance are paying. Shelling out about $318 million, or shelled out about $318 million in 2002 to cover the medical costs for uninsured folks in the state of Washington. In the year 2004, it's going to shoot up over $400 million. Now, the way that we pay for uninsured folks, if people are not familiar with this issue, is we pay through our taxes. So we pay that way because our taxes help to support hospitals in the state. We pay through increased medical costs. So when you go to the doctor and excuse me, and your And your little procedure or your ordinary doctor visit is now almost double what it used to be. That's one of the ways that you pay. And we pay through health insurance premiums. So if your boss tells you, I'm sorry, I can't give you as big a raise this year as I could in the past because your health insurance premiums have increased, or your boss comes to you and says, you got to now cough up half the cost of your health insurance premium yourself. Or if you are self-insured, if you have to pay for your own insurance and your insurance costs have been increasing by double-digit figures every year, that's another way that you pay. Now, in Washington State, there's more than 500,000 people, so about 550,000 people who are uninsured. 75% of those folks are people who work. That's an astonishing figure. 75% of those people are people who have jobs already and are not getting health insurance through their workplace. Now, one of the proposals that's going to be coming up for the state legislature this next year is heavily supported by the unions. It's a requirement that would force employers who have more than 50 employees to provide health insurance for their employees or to pay a fee to the state to cover health insurance costs. Now, that would mean that businesses like Walmart, for example, couldn't get away with paying minimum wage and not providing health insurance and therefore be able to have a competitive advantage over businesses that do pay a decent wage and provide health insurance. And Walmart wouldn't get a free break, in other words, a state subsidy, because other people in the state and the state of Washington has to pay the health care costs for their employees.
Yeah, at the same time, you know, the whole notion that health care has to be tied to one's work as opposed to being, you know, something that's available to everybody is just ridiculous. I mean, you know, there's no particularly good reason why health care has to be tied to employment.
Yeah, that's another thing that could happen. It's not there's not a proposal for it. Coming up to the legislature.
about the time that heck freezes over, yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, it was something that was started with the basic health...
In this country, anyway.
It was something that started with the state's basic health plan a while back when the basic health plan was passed. I believe it was early 90s.
'92,
yeah, when the basic health care plan passed in the state legislature and was originally set up. It was meant to be a place where people could, if they couldn't get health insurance anywhere else, they could join the state's basic health plan. But almost immediately, in the next year or two, state Republicans gutted the plan, pretty much, made it really, really difficult for the plan to remain competitive. And since then, there have been cuts and more cuts and deeper cuts. And there's a huge waiting list, and it's very, very hard for people to get on at all. You have to have a family to get on. If you're single, you can't get on anymore. It's just insane. So really what needs to happen is overall healthcare reform in this country, not just in the state. But in the meantime, these stopgap measures might help to make things a little more equitable and a little less costly in the future.
Well, I know if you look at the negotiations that are going on with different unions here, both in the state and nationally, for instance, let's say the grocery workers locally, it's health care costs that are the big thing that are really driving.
And that's been true for several years now, that the rollbacks on health care costs have been a major, major issue on all sorts of labor fronts. And it doesn't look like it's going to get any better, because if you're a small business or a medium-sized business, I mean, from the business standpoint, health care costs are brutal on them, too. So
that's right.
You know, it really does come back to this idea that we have to insert all these middle people that have to get their cut of the profits in order to have a healthcare delivery system in this country.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you'd think that, you know, with these corporations that are bearing currently, or not so much as they used to, the costs for this healthcare, that they would extend some of their leverage with these healthcare, not necessarily the providers, but the insurance companies, towards fixing things, and yet they don't appear to be lifting a finger.
Well, there are some that are backing this plan in the state legislature. But again, this plan is only a stopgap measure. It's not something that would set up a single-payer system. That's something that is still a dirty word in the U.S., and I don't understand why.
Mm. All right, anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right, well, the deficit got some attention today.
Yes, it did, folks. Like I said, if you open up your newspaper this morning, you'll
see
a record deficit.
The daily double.
We have a winner.
You have won the jackpot. The biggest debt biggest debt that
we've ever seen.
You ever had in the history of the United States. But you'll hear the Bush administration say all kinds of things about, oh, well, you know, it's not the biggest in terms of percentage of gross national product and blah, 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 blah. Well, I mean, look, 4 years ago, there was a surplus, and now that's gone, and the deficit is double what the surplus was at its peak. And in addition, the Bush administration's figures for getting rid of the deficit does not involve anything like balancing the budget, for example. Their figures involve increased tax revenue, which they say is going to come because the economy will suddenly start growing at a very fast pace. Now, the pace that they're projecting is 5.5% for the third and fourth quarter of this year, and they're hoping that that's going to continue into next year and the year after, and that that will eventually wipe out the deficit. However,
and by the context, what was it for the second quarter?
Well, for the second quarter, it was about 4%. So it had fallen. Actually, it's less than it was in the prior quarter. And the economy has not been growing at a 5.5% rate since before the recession. Only one quarter did it show growth over that amount. So to expect that to suddenly start happening in the last 6 months of this year, I think, is being way too optimistic. Now, we just had a decrease. Also, we just saw a decrease in consumer spending. People are looking at their debt burden and increased interest rates on their credit cards and their adjustable rate mortgages. And they're saying, I'm sorry, I can't continue to spend money at this rate and pay off my debt as well. And then folks are seeing too that their income's not increasing, and they're being asked to pay for healthcare insurance costs and various other things. So that's creating a slowdown as well. So I think the Bush administration is dreaming if they think that the deficit is gonna go down. It's gonna have to increase. And in addition, the Bush administration's figures for reducing the deficit don't include any additional money for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. There's money in the budget right now through January of next year, and after that, you know, more is going to have to come out of the federal treasury, and it's going to mean a bigger and bigger deficit.
All right, so no end in sight.
No end in sight for that. Unless, of course, there's a regime change.
Okay.
That might make a difference, and a repeal of some of the idiotic tax cut laws that we've had in the last couple of years.
Okay, well, with that, I guess that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
Yes, there was supposed to be this week the start of a 3-day conference in Iraq. 1,000 Iraqis were supposed to get together and choose 100 members for a new council that would oversee the interim government of Ayad Alawi. They would be able to veto things that Alawi had passed, and they would be able to also set up the conditions for elections to occur in January of next year. Now, how the selection process was going on actually made a difference in whether or not the conference could continue, because it turns out on Thursday, the day the conference was supposed to start, the Iraqi government announced, oh, sorry, we're going to postpone the conference for 2 weeks. Now, there's some reasons for that. There was absolute chaos in choosing the 1,000 delegates who would go to the caucus, who would choose the 100-member council. Now, there were supposed to be application forms, but it turns out that the application forms weren't distributed everywhere in Iraq, and that's a major problem. There was no public effort to explain the political process, and so with the lack of public outreach, there was a lot of protesting by ordinary Iraqis saying, how come we didn't know about this until a couple of days ahead of time? Some of the invitations, yes, there were invitations issued to people to apply or to sit on the 1,000-member caucus. Some of the invitations went out. They were sent by the preparatory committee, which was largely dominated by people who had sat on the original governing council. And as we all know, the folks who controlled the original governing council were mostly exile groups. Now, there are a couple of groups that were trying to hijack the process. In addition, one was Ahmed Chalabi and his group. They were trying, Ahmed Chalabi's trying to stay in control since he was booted out of contention for the interim government. He wasn't allowed to really push himself forward to be prime minister or president of the interim government. So now he's pushing really, really hard to be in control of the 100-member council. Now, of the 100-member council, 20 seats have already been set aside for former governing council members, and you can bet he's one of those 20 who will be sitting on that 100-member body. So already he doesn't have to work. He doesn't have to be chosen by anybody to get on the 100-member council. He's already got his ticket.
Isn't this guy, like, wanted somewhere or something?
Oh, yeah. He's wanted in Jordan, isn't it?
Yeah.
For bank fraud.
Yeah, $22 million. No, I mean, it just seems like, what does it take to take this guy out?
Well, maybe arresting him would help.
Yeah, exactly.
charging him with something would help. again, this is the guy who came up with falsified intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. He's one of the key guys.
Spying for Iran, defrauding the Pentagon, you just go down the list.
He's one of the key guys who talked Paul Bremer into the debathification process and dissolving the Iraqi military, which has led directly to the insurgency. So, I mean, he's one of these people who you would love to see him just suddenly disappear, because then things would immediately improve. But here he is. He's angling for control of this new supposedly democratic body. Now, in addition, another group that's trying to hijack the process, there are a number of religious groups who are vying for a lot of seats, particularly the two Shiite groups who have united, the Dawah Party, who was heavily supported by the Bush administration, and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, another group not so heavily supported by the Bush administration, but they were a prominent exile group supported by Iran. So these two groups of Shiite religious, they're pretty much Shiite almost fundamentalist religious groups, and I suppose you could argue that they are fundamentalist religious groups, are really angling for a lot of seats in the caucus and on the eventual 100-member council. So, in addition, there was a lot of infighting in the cities and provinces over who the delegates will be to the 1,000-member caucus. Now, in places like Kirkuk, for example, you had Kurds, Arabs, and Turkmen fighting over the mix of ethnic delegates who would be sent to the 1,000-member caucus, and it was so bad, the fighting was so bad in Kirkuk, that they had to throw out the initial selection of delegates and say, we got to start this all over again, because it's just turned out to be an absolute mess. In places like Basra, there's been threats of violence. The Dawah Party and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq united, got together, and pushed out any other delegates, particularly people who wanted to, who had a lot of support from al-Sadr's camp, from Muqtada al-Sadr. They just completely pushed him out of the process. And in turn, the al-Sadr group turned around and threatened violence. Said, if you don't let us participate, we're going to start killing you. And of course, that's not democracy. So that's been a complete and total mess and complete chaos. In addition, there are several groups boycotting the council selection process. Muqtada al-Sadr came out and said, this process sucks. We're not even going to participate because it's not democratic, obviously. The Association of Muslim Scholars, the largest and most respected group of the largest and most respected Sunni representative group in the country, has said that they will not participate too. And then various smaller nationalist groups, including groups that have no religious links at all, or are composed of people who span the gamut as far as religious and ethnic groups in the country, have decided not to participate too. And it's all being done in a huge hurry. So some districts didn't find out about the selection process until last week, and they're scrambling to hold elections to try to make it somewhat democratic, elections of the delegates to make it somewhat democratic. And some areas only had one day in which to select the delegates that would go to the 1,000-member caucus. So in the face of all these problems, the UN on Tuesday asked the Iraqi government to delay the process for 2 weeks. At first, the government resisted, and then on Thursday, they finally threw up their hands and said, "We can't do this alone. We need UN help." Okay, 2 weeks delay. The problem is that the U.S.'s timeline that they put down for the election process said that this council was supposed to be up and running by August 1st, and it's obviously not going to happen according to that timeline. And folks are saying, okay, once this thing is up and running, if it gets up and running, are they going to have enough time to put together a plan for elections in January? And we'll see.
Yeah, and I have to say that the coverage of all of this in U.S. media has just been awful. You get these puff piece articles that talk about, you know, finally democracy comes to Iraq, you know, talking about this election process in various cities and towns, and it's just been so patronizing. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we look at the Democratic National Convention this week, and some of us might think, well, at one point in this process, the Democratic National Convention was actually a place where people voted on who was going to...
And made decisions. Yeah,
and made some kind of decision. And here it's obviously Kerry was chosen from the beginning. And,
yeah, the whole thing is rigged. There's democracy for
you. Yeah, you get there and there's no vote. And so you know, we come and we try to impose this caucus process on the Iraqi people, and they're standing there going, "What? This doesn't look like democracy to me." And we're saying, hey, it's how we do it in the U.S. You know, people who had control, like the main exile groups on the governing council, you know, they go out to the provinces and they say, here, this is how you select the delegates. We'll tell you who the delegates should be and you vote on them. The Iraqis, that doesn't look like democracy to them. And I think that's a natural, normal, and a healthy instinct. And so the fact that it's chaos and that there's been delay is actually a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing, that you can't rush democracy. Real democracy takes time. And that's actually, I think,
a good thing. And not only takes time, but the ground rules for it can't be imposed from above either.
Yeah, it has to look like democracy for people to be invested in it.
Yeah, and it has to look like something that's organic, that came out from the culture that it's trying to govern.
Right, and in the last couple minutes here, last minute or two here, I just want to talk about the Coalition Provisional Authority Inspector General came out with a second report this week to Congress. It's the first formal audit of the contracting procedures in Iraq. They looked at 178 major contracts worth more than $5 million each that were awarded in the last year. And the result is that 69 criminal investigations of fraud and/or theft have been filed. 27 of those are still open. They couldn't find any documentation for 14 of the contracts. Most of the contracts had inadequate documentation, which they said was a systemic problem. In 2003, the Coalition Provisional Authority awarded 66% of its contracts on a no-bid basis. So they simply awarded them to whomever they wanted to without looking at any kind of a bid. Now, the CPA didn't issue standard operating procedures or set up a review and evaluation system at all, as far as they could tell, at least not until the very last few months. Now, the auditors couldn't track down 52 of 164 randomly selected items in an inventory of equipment overseen by Kellogg Brown and Root. That's the Halliburton subsidiary operating in Iraq. That included two generators worth $1 million each, 18 trucks and SUVs, and 6 laptop computers. They just couldn't find them. Now, the report also noted that the same or worse problems applied to the Coalition Provisional Authority's use of over $20 billion in Iraqi oil funds. And that still remains an enormous mystery, what happened to that money, because there were, as far as they could tell, no records kept of much of where those funds went.
And that buttresses reports we've had before on the same funds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was the first formal audit.
Not the first one. Good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After all that time.
Now that the Coalition Provisional Authority doesn't exist anymore.
All right. Well, we are almost out of time, but there's a big event today we wanted to let people know about that didn't Catch the 7:30 hour?
Yeah, Rolling Thunder is coming out to Magnuson Park. This is the project that was initiated a couple years ago by Jim Hightower, and he will be in town as part of this today. Other luminaries will be in town as well, and there will be workshops and bands.
Lots of workshops.
And speakers and all that kind of good stuff. It'll be out at Magnuson Park from, noon to 6?
Noon to 8.
Noon to 8. Okay.
We're going all day.
And it's free of charge, I believe.
No, $10.
No, it is $10. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
but
never mind.
We'll have a table there if folks want to come by and visit us.
We will be out there. Eat the State will be out there.
I'll be there.
And I'll be on a panel with Paul Loeb and some other folks in the afternoon as well.
Very good. So it should be a beautiful day to go out and enjoy the weather.
Yeah, and I understand in Magnuson Park, because it's a big area, that folks need to go in the 74th Street entrance rather than the beach entrance.
Over by the soccer fields.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. All right. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell us, where do we find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free stuff around town. We can be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you want to call us up and complain about the fact that we talk about Iraq all the time, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461 and tell us what you think democracy should look like.